Okay, glad you all could make it. It's nice to see so many familiar faces and also so many new people joining us as well. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a principal technical writer on the Exchange team. Among other things, I'm responsible for the product documentation around high availability, site resilience, disaster recovery, some storage and virtualization and deployment stuff as well. And I'm pleased to be back at another TechEd Europe talking a bit about Exchange 2010 tips and tricks. So I know I see some of you with cameras and devices taking pictures and whatnot. That's cool if you want to do that. But all of the slides are uploaded to ComNet, so you can download them. With one exception, there's a surprise in here for you guys that I didn't upload. And the sessions are being recorded. And you can go to msteched.com after the event and watch the whole thing over and over and over again, which I know some of you will do. So feel free to relax, sit back, and just enjoy and learn some stuff. But again, if you want to take pictures, that's very cool. So I've got a couple announcements we're going to start with, and we'll talk briefly about the basics of Exchange 2010 SP2. I know that Jeff did a wonderful session already on the insider's view of SP2, so I'm not going to cover largely anything that he covered. I am going to talk about some tools that admins are going to want to know about, some of which you may already be using, some of which you might not be using, but might want to be aware of those. I'll also give you a nice assortment of random tips. These are things that I and others at Microsoft have recently used to help customers in different scenarios. So I'll describe the scenarios and the solutions we came up with for them in Exchange. And then I'm going to end with some known issues. And these are hot issues that we see out in the field that we know about and that we're working on, but we don't have fixes for, but I want to tell you about so that you can learn about them as well and be aware of them in case you're not already. So let's start with the announcements. The first one is not Exchange related at all, but I thought it was cool enough to share with the TechEd audience. This is something we've released called the One Pager. Has anybody heard of this? And I'm not surprised if no hands go up because it's very, very new. So what is the One Pager? What if you wanted to see a view of all of Microsoft products, whether it was everything enterprise and consumer, or maybe for those of us who are just here, we're just in the enterprise space? Have any of you ever had that need to, you just need to show all the products to a customer, to some entity? Anybody ever run into anything like that? Okay, well, what I want to show you is we've recently done this. Switch over here. And what we're actually doing is it's a very large poster that we've created. And it lists all of the products that we make. And it's got them all rolled up into one nice view. And we use Silverlight, and in particular, a feature of Silverlight called Deep Zoom, so that we can do things like zoom into this poster and get very, very high resolution. So obviously, this is a poster, something that you could print out as well. And it would be quite large if you did so. But for those of you who like seeing things online, you can scroll around this, you can move around, there's APIs so that you can hook into it and so forth. And it's kind of a cool thing that we've released that I thought I'd share, even though, like I said, it's not directly Exchange related. I thought it was interesting enough. And we have enough customers who ask for these kinds of things where I thought it was worth sharing. So I hope you like that. It is something we're planning on updating quarterly. It's being driven by a separate team. Again, it's not an Exchange thing, but it's something that I think is pretty useful, and it's a nice, handy reference to have. Now, the Exchange announcement. And this is exclusive for TechEd Europe. We did not announce this or share this at TechEd North America 2 weeks ago. So this is exclusive actually for this audience. No one knows about this outside of Microsoft until now. How many of you have heard of the Exchange Remote Connectivity Analyzer? All right, awesome, that's great. Well, we've done some updates to it. The updates are not available to the public yet, but they are available to you because I'm giving you the URL for our staging server, and you can go to our staging server and try out the updates yourself. So what are some of the updates that we have? Well, we've done significant work in improving the CAPTCHA experience. You may have seen the video, one of the videos when you were walking in, where the issue with the CAPTCHA is if you get anything wrong, it blows away your password, or you get timed out and you have to re-enter it multiple times. It's just not a good experience. And we did a lot of work in the next version of it, which you're seeing for a pre-release right now, to go ahead and make that experience better. We've also done a lot of work in the tests themselves. There was some work we did for both inbound and outbound SMTP. In particular, the outbound SMTP test is now RFC compliant. It was not in a couple of respects. It is now. We've also done some work around the certificate experience, particularly around the older Windows mobile clients. And we've also enhanced the experience for those of you using UAG as well, around the Outlook Anywhere ping proxy test and the HTTP authentication tests that we do inside the app. So if you look at the app, if you actually go to it, you're going to see that it doesn't look remarkably different from what you're used to. If you haven't seen the app, just go to www.exrca.com, and it will redirect you to the actual site, which is the testexchangeconnectivity.com. Now, I'm actually on the staging server, which is stg-testexchangeconnectivity.com, so it's a different domain altogether. And that's the domain where we are now hosting the 1.4 preview that all of you can go and start playing with ahead of everybody else. So because this is a public event, yes, you are the first people to see it, but it's not confidential, so feel free to share it with your colleagues who maybe couldn't make the session or couldn't make the show. So it's a very powerful tool. If you haven't checked it out, I'm going to be talking a little bit more about it in a bit, but I wanted to announce this, got permission from the PM who developed the tool to announce it exclusively to you, so hope you guys enjoy it. Okay, now let's get on to the basics, but quick and first check, how many of you are already running 2010 SP2? Great. How many of you running 2007? Any 2003? Any 2000? No. 5.5? No. Okay. One. We have one. There's always one. Okay. Well, let's talk about the basics. Most of you are probably up to speed. I mean, quite frankly, the service pack came out last December, as you can see. So it's not exactly new stuff that we're talking about. But for those of you who don't know, I mean, it did come out in December. It took us almost a year to develop it. And I know Jeff gave a lot of the insights as to what it's like in terms of our servicing model for service packs. The latest update roll-up that came out, that's pretty new. It came out last month, almost a month ago. That's update roll-up 3. That's got many, many bug fixes in it. If you're not on SP2 yet, you want to go to SP2 first and then go to update roll-up 3. SP2 in particular, in addition to the 4 major features that Jeff talked about, has a lot of minor enhancements as well and more than 500 bug fixes in it. So you definitely want to get the latest code up and running on your system right away. And, of course, I've got build numbers and lots of URLs for you as well. You will see in my slides and some of the other Exchange presentations that you see, you're going to see these URLs that are aka.ms/something. Those are URLs that we can create internally at Microsoft. You can't create them, but you can use any of them. And they'll just redirect you to a URL that you would normally use, like a TechNet URL or a Download Center URL. But we try to make them handy little shortcut vanity URLs so that you can quickly go to your destination. You don't even need to think about the aka.ms part. Just think about what's on the other side of the slash, and that will get you there instantly. So, for instance, if you wanted to find out what's new in SP2, E14 SP2 new, if you wanted to find out what's in the update rollup, E14 SP2 UR3. Pretty simple notation. We also do maintain a complete list of all of the versions and builds of Exchange that we've released. So not just for 2010 or the service packs or the update rollups, but we also maintain a complete list of every version of Exchange we've released. And that's handy to have because if you're in a large environment, you're probably running a mixture of Exchange versions. You may be running SP2 on some, maybe SP1 on some, maybe different versions of update rollups. And it can get confusing, particularly when you look in the Exchange Management Console and you just see the build information without any notation as to whether that's a service pack or an update rollup. So now we've got one URL you can go to. It'll give you every single thing you want to know about the versions and builds for every release of Exchange that we've had. And speaking of server editions, just so everybody's clear, historically we've only had 2 server editions, the standard and the enterprise. And the only difference between those 2 editions are the number of databases that are supported by the mailbox role. In standard, it's a maximum of 5. In enterprise, it's a maximum of 100. OK? Okay, that's the only reason to go for the Enterprise Edition of Exchange if you need more than 5 mailbox databases at any given time on a mailbox server. By 5 mailbox databases, any combination of active or passive, we count them both. The only type of database we don't count is the recovery database. That does not count against the 100. Now, about a year ago, or maybe almost 2 years ago now, we introduced a third edition of Exchange. When we first introduced it, we called it the coexistence edition. You may have noticed that we don't really use the term coexistence too much anymore. And instead, we've moved on to the term hybrid. And we use the term hybrid to describe a topology that includes both on-premises Exchange installations, which could be 2010 or earlier, and cloud-based deployments as well through Office 365. And as you might imagine, it's the hybrid server that is used to connect them together. So what is the hybrid server? Well, it's a regular Exchange server. The only difference is when you put a product key in it, instead of identifying itself as standard or enterprise, it gets identified as the hybrid edition. And the hybrid edition is basically a free server that you get. Of course, you provide the hardware, you provide the operating system, but we'll provide you with the Exchange license. You can go to the download center, download Exchange 2010 SP2, get it in all in one, install it, call up Office 365 support or use the web portal, open up a support case and request a hybrid edition product key, which they will send you for free. You put the product key in, it identifies itself as a hybrid server, and that server is now the connection endpoint between the on-premises organization and the cloud-based mailboxes that you have as well. The only thing you want to be concerned about with the hybrid server is its use, because it's free, is limited to that relationship only. If it's used for any other purpose outside the scope of that hybrid relationship, if you put public folders on it, if you put mailboxes on it, et cetera, if you do anything outside the scope of that agreement, you will have to go ahead and purchase a regular license for it. But as long as you're just using it in the context of the hybrid connection, the license is free. And in fact, we'll give you multiple licenses if you're large enough where you need multiple hybrid servers as well. Now, if you happen to be a trial customer of Office 365, you've got accounts, but you haven't bought it yet, you're still trying it, you don't get the free key. That's only for customers who've actually purchased Office 365. But that's okay, because technically you don't really need it to get the functionality. You simply download SP2 and leave it in trial edition, leave it without a product key, and use it in the context of a hybrid server. It's that simple. So if you're just testing it out and you want to see what the hybrid experience looks like, you can do that without needing a key and without having to purchase Office 365. Okay, now how many of you, remind me, how many of you are running SP2 already? Okay, how many of you are still on SP1? How many of you are on RTM? Okay. No hands on RTM. Okay, pretty good. Okay, so the RTM to SP2 upgrade is a little bit heavier than SP1 to SP2. But regardless of where you're coming from, when you go to SP2, there's going to be two different types of schema updates that you're going to have to deal with. One is the Active Directory schema updates. And that's not so new for many Exchange administrators. We've been doing AD schema updates with many Exchange releases, including major releases and service pack releases. And in fact, it was largely because of the four new features that we introduced, things like OA Mini and address book policies and so forth, that we had to introduce some schema changes in Active Directory. So your first installation of SP2 is going to make irrevocable changes to your AD schema, which will be replicated throughout the environment. If you're in a very, very large environment, you might want to plan for that. It could end up being a lot of replication traffic. If you're in a medium-sized environment or a small environment, or of course if you've already applied the service pack, then it's not such a big deal for you. The bigger deal, though, is with respect to the schema updates we're doing at the database level itself. So schema, remember, is just the term for how you lay out data in some sort of repository, like Active Directory or a mailbox database. And in SP2, we have done some work to update and upgrade the database schema that we use as well. And what that means is when you apply SP2, we're not just updating the binaries that are on the box. We're also making changes to the database format itself. That's going to add time to your upgrade. Okay? In the case of small databases, it might only be maybe 10, 15 minutes additional time that it's going to add. If you were coming from RTM to SP2, it would be much longer, be more like a half hour, maybe 40 minutes per database, because when we do those upgrades, we have to go from RTM to SP1 to SP2. We can't skip over. So it's much longer, but no one here said they were on RTM, so you shouldn't be impacted by that. But you will be impacted by the upgrader going from SP1 to SP2. And until that database is actually upgraded to the SP2 schema, it won't be mountable by that server, which means that will be extra downtime. Now, many of you mitigate that by using database availability groups and replicating your databases, and that's great. But there's also some concerns in a DAG as well. Because in a DAG, you're only going to upgrade so many servers at a time. Some of them are going to be active servers that you won't be upgrading. The rest will be passive servers that you'll upgrade. Then you'll move the active database over. And once you take an upgraded passive server and you move a database over to it, that database becomes the SP2 format, and it can no longer be mounted and made active on a pre-SP2 system. So you sort of have to leapfrog your databases around as you're doing your DAG upgrades to avoid unanticipated downtime as a result of having nowhere for an SP2 database to fail over to. So keep that in mind. That could add some additional time as well. But keep in mind with the DAG, though, the quicker that you can do the upgrade, the less your risk is. And in fact, as you progress with the upgrade, the risk gets less and less because the number of servers that you can't move to becomes fewer and fewer and fewer. So do those upgrades as quickly as you can. Be aware of the issues when you're upgrading the databases in particular, especially in a DAG, because it could affect star over capabilities for those databases. Okay, now I want to talk about the top 10 tools, but I want to say a couple things about it first. First, I'm not including our core tools like JetStress and LoadGen. Those are number one and number two on every list because they should be used to validate every environment. But I'm going to talk about the tools you would use after the environment's in place. I will say, though, that they're in no particular order. There's not one tool that would be more important than another tool. They're all unique. They're all based on different scenarios and so forth. And as I said, some of these maybe you've heard of and are using. Some of these maybe you haven't. And, of course, there's many more than just 10 tools. There's lots and lots of other tools for Exchange. These, though, are the 10 tools that I think every Exchange administrator really needs to be familiar with because they will, at some point in their messaging system career, have to use one of these tools. So let's start with the calendar checking tool for Outlook. Anybody heard of CalCheck? All right, awesome. That actually doesn't surprise me because calendar problems can be somewhat common. You know, I bet if I were to say, how many of you have experienced calendar problems with your own mailboxes? Yeah, exactly. So, and you'll hear later on that the issues actually get worse now with the proliferation of different devices that are coming in as well. But we'll talk about that in a bit. But if you are experiencing calendar issues, then the CalCheck tool is something that you might want to check out. There is calendar assistant functionality in Exchange, and it actually does a very good job of reconciling broken meetings. So, for instance, if I'm supposed to be in a meeting and it's not on my calendar, but it is on the organizer's calendar, the calendar assistant can recognize that and put the meeting back on my calendar, or vice versa. If it's on my calendar, but for some reason it fell off the organizer's calendar, the calendar assistant can come in and fix those things too. But the CalCheck tool, that's really there to help with things on the Outlook side, not necessarily on the server side as well. So the server side's handled by the calendar assistant. The CalCheck tool handles the Outlook side of it. And that sweeps for common problems. It's not going to fix every single calendar problem that you have. But if there are calendaring issues, this tool is preferred to be run before you would do something like clean free busy or start wiping out appointments to fix whatever problem you're troubleshooting. So it's pretty new. If you've checked it out before, we actually, within less than a month ago, released an updated version of it to 1.2. So check it out if you haven't already. Speaking of updates, just literally 3.5 days ago, we released an update to the Exchange Client Network Bandwidth Calculator as well. Anybody tried that out yet? It's still in beta, so it's okay if you haven't seen it yet. This is a fairly significant update that we've just done to this tool, though. The previous beta that we had, beta 2, did not take into account what we're calling the time zone phenomenon or the time zone problem. And that is, it's one thing to calculate the bandwidth needs by your clients based on the actual client type and the protocol and the user's profile, but it's a slightly different thing to calculate what the trends are going to be until you actually figure out where those clients are with respect to time zones and when they might be logging on to the system. If everybody, for example, is in the same time zone and they all log on at the same time, that's one traffic pattern. But if you have people spread across the globe, some are logging in this time, others are logging in 6 hours later, 8 hours later, and so forth, you're going to have a slightly different traffic pattern to deal with. And now with the client bandwidth calculator, we have some rudimentary mechanisms. They're not going to solve all the problems for you, but some rudimentary mechanisms in there to handle this time zone problem and give you a bit more meaningful calculation. It is a beta. We would love to have your feedback on it, so please, you know, download it and try it out and use the alias right in the tool to send the feedback directly to the tool owner. Mailbox server role requirements calculator. How many of you have heard of this? Awesome. Not as many hands as I'd hoped, though. I think this is something that everybody needs to know about. And in fact, we just released an updated version of this. We're now at version 19.9 that came out, again, just a few days ago. And this has some pretty significant enhancements and changes as well. So if you're using the previous version, which was 18.9, now it's time to go get the new one and upgrade to 19.9. If you haven't used this tool, we introduced it first in Exchange 2007. It was called the Mailbox Server Storage Calculator, because largely in 2007, that's what we were focused on. In 2010, we expanded what this tool could do. We started focusing on bandwidth, on network capabilities, on continuous replication, on database copy layouts, on LUN design, and so forth. And it was doing so much more than just storage that we decided to give it a new name, the Mailbox Server Role Requirements Calculator. When you're deploying an Exchange organization, whether it's an upgrade or a new organization, the most important thing that you can do is appropriately size the mailbox role. That's not just for the user's benefit. That's also because the other server roles, CAS and Hub, for example, their sizing is completely predicated upon the sizing that you get for the mailbox server. The way that you want to size all of your mailbox servers is to use the Mailbox Server Role Requirements Calculator. It's a spreadsheet in Excel. You put in a few metrics about your environment, what your networking is, what your site resilience needs are, how many copies of your databases are, what sort of data center layouts do you have, et cetera, user profile information. You plug that into the input page, and then we spit out a whole bunch of other pages that give you things like, hey, what your database copy layout should look like, or what your LUN layout should look like, or what your bandwidth needs are going to be based on the replication traffic we think you're going to have based on the metrics that you've given us. Once you have that information, then you can size the other server roles, and once you've done that, then you can validate the solution with JetStress and LoGen and make sure that pre-production, it's ready to go. So this is a very important tool for everybody to know. The Exchange Remote Connectivity Analyzer, we just talked about that because of the newness of it. If you haven't seen that, the idea behind this tool is it's designed to shortcut an administrator's workload. So the idea is an administrator's just deployed CAS in the environment, and they test Outlook at their desk. They test Outlook anywhere at their desk. Everything's working great. They can get into OWA and so forth. But historically, it wasn't until they went home later that night and were doing things from their home computer to verify that, oh, yeah, they had connectivity from outside the office as well. So a couple engineers in our product quality department in CSS came up with this idea of having a web service that's out there in one of our data centers that users could use that would do tests against their infrastructure as if the user were sitting at their own home computer using OWA or Outlook Anywhere or Telnet to test SMTP. That's where this tool was born out. So now instead of having to wait till later on that evening, the administrator can go to the website, www.exrca.com, put in information, choose the test that they want, and start testing things like Outlook Anywhere connectivity, auto-discover, inbound and outbound SMTP, web services, single sign-on with Office 365, and many, many other tests as well. So this is an excellent tool for validating external client connectivity without having to leave the office. And what's beautiful about this is it doesn't just do the tests. It also tells you where the tests succeed and where the tests fail. And when the tests fail, you've got a pretty good indication as to why they failed. Couldn't open a port, certificate didn't match, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever the problem is, the tool will tell you what it is and give you clues as to how to fix that. Now, the Microsoft Outlook Configuration Analyzer, OCAT. Who's heard of this tool? Okay, a few hands. Okay, here's another tool you're going to want to know of. Now, CalCheck handles calendaring issues in Outlook. What OCAT does, and by the way, we released version 2.0 yesterday, so brand new. Whoops. Sorry, I didn't mean to go forward. So brand new version of OCAT. And what OCAT does, it saves you the time of blowing away and recreating profiles. How many of you have troubleshooted Outlook issues on the desktop and your only solution was to blow away and recreate the profile? Yeah. And that was not a good solution. Because in many cases, the end user's taken time to configure things just for them, and some of that unique profile information gets lost as a result of that. So rather than blow the profile away, you can actually use the OCAT tool, and it will scan the profile. We'll go into the registry and look at the MAPI information in there, and scan it and look for common configuration problems, problems where we know that, oh, if this entry's missing, Outlook's going to give this error message. If these entries are backwards or whatever, Outlook is not going to open the information store, those kinds of things. And we can do some pretty good analysis on it, and if we find out that there's a problem, OCAT will go in and fix it for you as well. But it will leave the original profile intact, and it will try to repair it without running the repair process, which can trigger other things, and without having to blow the profile away and recreate it. So again, 2.0 just came out yesterday. Check it out if you've already been using it. You want to get the newer version because of the enhancements that we've done. All right, how many of you are using PSTs in your environment? Okay, now keep your hands up if you love PSTs and you never want them to go away. As I said, there's always one. I'm not picking on you, but you did raise your hand. So PST Capture, what is that? That is actually a tool that we acquired from another company, and we bought it and brought it into Exchange and turned it into a more Exchange slash Microsoft type of tool, branded it, recoded some of the stuff, and then released it as the Microsoft PST Capture tool, a free tool that you can download that you can put in UNC paths or network paths and have it grab PSTs and import them into users' mailboxes or into users' archive mailboxes so that you can ultimately get all of that data from the tiny little files scattered around hard drives in your organization into the Exchange store where it belongs so that it can be backed up, replicated, protected, and more importantly, discovered. Okay, search mailbox, et cetera, et cetera. That discoverability is what's driving customers away from using PSTs. If I'm an organization and I get a subpoena to produce mail records, and those mail records are scattered across tens of thousands of desktop computers because they're held in PSTs, that's going to be very, very difficult for me to comply with that request. But if those PSTs happen to be imported into Exchange, and I can use the native Exchange e-discovery tools like multi-mailbox search and the discovery portal, that makes my job much, much easier. And it also protects the company, because a PST is a very portable file. It can contain proprietary information about your organization. It can contain personal information about your employees. And anybody could pick up that file, take it anywhere they want, and open it through about any Outlook reader, even if there's a password on it. There's password crackers out there for PSTs. And they can see all that information. Or worse, take that information to their next job and use your company's history and experience to the benefit of perhaps one of your competitors. So obviously the idea is to move away from PSTs as soon as possible, and the PST Capture tool is what we think one of the best ways of doing it. Again, in part because it's free. So check it out if you want to get rid of PSTs. This would be the tool to use it. I will say this, though. Even though the tool supports the import of PSTs over a network, and even though Exchange can also import and export PSTs over the network, we still do not support the use of PSTs by the Outlook client over a network as well. So keep that in mind. Even though you're starting to see us do more stuff with PSTs over the network on the server side, we still have the same rules and restrictions in place on the client side, which means the PST always has to be local on that Outlook desktop. Okay, the Exchange Server Deployment Assistant. Who's heard of this tool? Okay, not too many hands. I'm particularly proud of this tool because I helped build it. I did a lot of the content work in there. And the idea behind this tool is it's a website. You go to this website and you choose what you want to do. That could be upgrading from 2003, it could be upgrading from 2007, it could be upgrading from a mixture of two, it could be deploying a new organization, it could be migrating to a cloud-only organization. Any way that you want to go to Exchange 2010 on-premises or Office 365, that's what this tool's designed to do. You go to the website, you answer a couple questions, it's usually no more than four or five, and then the tool gives you step-by-step instructions for doing your deployment, starting with installing CAS, configuring CAS, moving on to Hub, moving on to Mailbox, and so forth. And the instructions also include a section at the bottom that says, how do I know this worked? Now, obviously, when you're running our wizards and commandlets and stuff, the end of the wizard or the end of the commandlet's going to give you a pretty good clue as to whether or not it succeeded or not. If you don't get an error message with commandlets, life is good. But that doesn't always mean like things are configured the way you want them. And so this section gives you other mechanisms that you can use to further validate the configuration before moving on to the next step. And it's a Silverlight application, so you can check off the steps that you've done. You can close the website and go back, and we'll persist all of your settings and changes so you can start back right from where you left off. It's also available for use in offline scenarios because once you have the instructions, you can print them, you can email them, or you can have the website itself convert them to PDF format, which you can then download and take into a disconnected network if you're installing an Exchange offline as well. We are constantly making enhancements to this tool as well. So each time you go to the website, it might look a little different because we're putting more and more stuff into it, particularly around hybrid scenarios and Office 365. But definitely check it out. Whether you're doing an upgrade or a fresh install, this is going to be the easiest and fastest way to actually do the deployment itself instead of having to wade through all the TechNet documentation that we have. Okay, MFC Mappy. Who's heard of that tool? I've already talked about it with some customers this week. This is a very, very powerful tool, but it's one that I think every Exchange administrator should try and use at least once. Because until you've actually seen what's really inside of a mailbox, until you've looked beyond what viewers like Outlook and OWA can show you, you don't really have an understanding of what's in there. And you could be misled as to what the true contents of a mailbox actually looks like. And so what I would invite you to do, because you'll all have permissions to do this innately, is to download MFC Mappy and use it to open your own mailbox. It uses the same Mappy profile that you'd be using for Outlook, so it's the same permissions, except that your mailbox will look very, very different when you see it through this tool. This is a very low-level, raw Mappy editor that will take you right into the tables and indices inside the mailboxes themselves. Now, there are no protection mechanisms inside this tool. There's no undo, there's no undelete, there's no warning dialogues. Whatever you do in that tool is immediate and permanent. Okay, so be very, very careful because this tool is exposing things that aren't exposed through any other interface. And if those things are misconfigured, deleted, damaged somehow, you could end up harming your mailbox. So I was almost a little hesitant to talk about the tool, but I think it's important enough for administrators who are responsible for managing mailbox servers to have an understanding of what's actually in the databases. And MFC Mappy is the best tool to provide you with that understanding. Now, this next tool doesn't actually have the name that I've given it on the slide. If you go to the website, it's actually called the Microsoft Active Directory Topology Diagrammer. But I changed it to Topology Mapper, and I did that because diagrammer's not a word. So I'm going to try and get the actual tool changed, but for right now, if you go to the website, it's called Diagrammer, which is why it's got the shortcut ADTD URL for Diagrammer. But it's really a mapper, and it's very similar to the old ADMAP program that we used to have. It's a program that will scrape Active Directory, look up objects in Active Directory, and then spit out in Visio a mapping of your AD topology and your Exchange topology. And then, of course, you companion it with our Visio stencils, and then you can add other Exchange shapes and stencils to that artwork as well. So if you need a quick way, maybe you've hired a consultant, or maybe you're working with MCS, or maybe you just want a diagram of what your topology looks like with all your AD servers and all your Exchange servers. That's what the AD topology diagrammer will do for you. It'll be called Mapper soon, though. Okay, so that's it for the tools. Now I want to move into the section where we sort of move around in different places and talk about all sorts of random things that have come up with customers lately. Some of these may be germane to your environments. Some may not, so bear with me. There's a pretty diverse collection here. I think there should be something in here for everyone, though. In fact, this in particular, I think, is going to be a very common issue. This is a phenomenon that we're seeing with newer network devices. You may have noticed in your own environments that some of the more newer network devices that are coming out and being put into production these days have significantly more aggressive network timeouts for HTTP and TCP than what we've historically seen in the past. Historically, the defaults have been largely around 15 minutes for the timeouts for TCP and for HTTP connectivity. You could always go in and change that on your server. There's some applications where you can change those defaults as well. But by and large, there has been a reasonable expectation of about a 15-minute or so timeout with respect to sessions and connectivity. So how many of you are familiar with Outlook Anywhere? Hopefully everybody. So you know we used to call it RPC over HTTP. The way we actually do Outlook Anywhere is it's still the same native mappy RPC stuff, but we wrap it around in HTTP, and it's sent to an RPC proxy, which then unwraps it, takes the RPC mappy stuff, and forwards it on through the system. The communication mechanism that we use is actually a two-way channel. So there's RPC data in, that's going from the client to the server, and RPC data out, coming from the server back to the client. What we're seeing with these network devices that have these aggressive timeouts is that we will lose one of those directions. RPC data in will send messages to the server, but the server won't be able to respond because the timeout has killed the RPC data out channel. And so the net effect of that is what you end up getting is messages that are being sent through an Outlook Anywhere client end up getting stuck in the outbox. Okay, and that's the hallmark of this particular issue. Now, how can you fix it? Well, the fix that we've come up with is to actually go into the registry and modify the default settings for the RPC proxy itself, which is a Windows component, not an Exchange component. And you modify that to add the key and configure it with a timeout of 120 seconds or 2 minutes. Once you've done that, that then eliminates this problem of messages getting stuck in the outbox when you're using Outlook Anywhere. Now, if you have messages stuck in your outbox and you are not using Outlook Anywhere, this is not the same problem. This is specific and unique to Outlook Anywhere. So if it's Outlook using TCP on the corporate that's stuck in the outbox, it's probably something else going on. It's not this at all because you're not using the RPC proxy. It's probably more something like the mail submission service isn't running, or there's a problem with the pickup queue or something. But if you have the specific issue of Outlook Anywhere and messages getting stuck in the outbox, this is the registry change that you would make. You're making it on the RPC proxy server itself, which for almost every Exchange customer is your client access servers. And you would need to make it on each one of the servers, each one of the CAS servers on which you've enabled Outlook Anywhere. You need to make this change. Again, this is a Windows change. It will affect all RPC proxy applications that are running on that box. In most cases, for most customers, that's only Outlook Anywhere on CAS. But we don't block you from installing other stuff, so if you are using other things that use RPC proxy as well, you will be altering their timeouts as well. Be aware of that. How many of you are using System Center Operations Manager? All right. Now, how many of you are using the Active Directory split permissions model inside of Exchange? Ooh, crickets chirping. So how many of you are using RBAC? Okay, well, that doesn't make sense. We only have two permission model, and that wasn't enough hands. So some of you might not be aware what you're using, and if that's the case, if you're not sure, you're using RBAC, because RBAC is the default. The only way you get into the split permissions model is initially in setup, when you check that box, or you use the command line version, or if you run some special commandlets after the fact to convert from RBAC to the split permission model. If you're not sure what the difference is, RBAC is the built-in role-based access control. That's a permission model that we're using to assign roles and role groups, et cetera, and functionality to delegates, administrators, users, etc. The split permission model is designed for organizations that have one team that manages AD and a separate team that manages Exchange, hence split permissions. There is a challenge when you're using the split permission model, because in the split permission model, we are basically taking the Exchange permissions away from the AD admins and taking non-Exchange AD object management capabilities away from Exchange admins. When you're running with System Center and the Operations Manager and the Management Packs, these management packs run by doing what's called synthetic transactions against the server. So a synthetic transaction is the same as a user transaction, except it's done by the system and not an actual user. That's why we call them synthetic. There's a problem when you're using the split permissions model. So nobody seemed to be affected by it, so I'm not going to go into it in too detail, but you should be aware of it. There is an issue where there's some extra configuration that you need to do in order for the synthetic transactions to actually execute in the split permission model. And I actually have all the steps for you in the slides. Again, it didn't seem like anybody was largely affected by it, so I'm not going to go through them all. You'll have them in the deck if you are affected by it, though. But generally, there's just a couple things that you have to do. It's not too many steps. It's just these 8 steps. And then once you're done with that, now SCOM and the management pack will function as expected when you're using the split permission model. One of the reasons I mention this is because we actually have not made this into the documentation yet. There's an open bug that we're still working on to get this documented. So if you or anyone you know is faced with this issue, this deck is actually the only place to find these steps right now. So keep that in mind. Okay, how many of you are familiar with the various levels of throttling that we have built into Exchange? Okay, and how many of you are familiar with the RPC client access throttling? It's probably one of the more common ones you'd encounter because it's throttling of the Outlook Anywhere clients. So what is throttling? Throttling is when the system slows things down in response to a workload that exceeds a certain threshold. So there are defaults that we have in terms of throttling. If they go above those thresholds, the system will throttle. It'll push connections back. It'll slow connections down, et cetera. And of course, if you need to, you can always increase those thresholds, or you can troubleshoot whatever problems are causing them and so forth. But with RPC client access throttling by default, you don't really have a good indication as to what's going on. About the most visibility you get into the throttling activity itself by default is by looking at the perfmon counters. And the perfmon counters are good because they're giving you some information, but they're not really telling you the whole picture. They're not really telling you who is throttled and why. Okay, so what you can do, however, is turn on and enable logging for RPC client access throttling. And that's what this is intended to do. So if you open up the microsoft.exchange.rpcclientaccess.service.exe.config... and you go in there and you find the logging tag area. At the end where you see the connect, disconnect, etc., just add the word throttling. Put a comma after warnings, add the word throttling, save it, recycle the IIS web pool for that. That change will take effect, and now we will start logging the RPC throttling activity as well inside the log files for you. So this will give you very good visibility now into what throttling is occurring and why, and you won't be stuck just looking at performance counters wondering what's happening. Of course, if you are seeing a lot of throttling, that could be indicative of some more prevalent problem like undersized server or overutilized server through BYOD, those kinds of things. All right. Here's an interesting take on a tip I was talking about a few years ago where you have a scenario where you're going to fire somebody. Okay, and you as the administrator said, hey, so-and-so is about to get fired, and we want them out of their mailbox now, but they don't know that they're going to be fired. So how do we handle that? Well, historically, there was a problem with that. In the 2003, 2007, and earlier days, the issue was that we were caching some of the relationship between that client and the server so that even if you were to disable the user's mailbox, they could still go in and have access to that mailbox, which, again, is not what you want for someone who's about to be fired. So what you would also have to do is you would have to do extra steps, like set the send prohibit quota to 0. That stopped them from sending messages. And then you would move the mailbox, because prior to Exchange 2010, anytime you would move a mailbox, it would kick the user out and disconnect them. And that was the perfect way to get them out. As long as they remained connected, they could get back in and do malicious things. Well, fast forward to ActiveSync devices. Well, it turns out they're facing now a similar phenomenon. When you wipe an ActiveSync device, whether it's a local wipe from a bad password or a remote wipe that an administrator is doing through the control panel, that does not take care of everything. That only wipes what's on the device. That does not destroy the partnership with the device. The partnership itself is, in fact, stored in the mailbox, which means there's also a grace period for the user to reconnect that device as well, usually about 24 to 48 hours. What happens is the device gets wiped. They say, oh, I got to go and re-enter my mail. And if it's within that grace period, they can then go back in and have access to their mailbox, even though you've wiped the device and maybe even disabled the mailbox, because that partnership is still valid and the caching is still occurring for the 24 to 48 hours. So just like you had to do with the Outlook clients, now you've got the same phenomenon with ActiveSync clients as well. And OWA clients as well in some cases, because there's caching that we do in OWA too. So it's the same thing. Disable the mailbox, set the send prohibit quota to zero, and then in the case of on-premises, you can move the mailbox, but again, the user won't be kicked out until the move is at the end and we do the disconnect and reconnect them to their new mailbox. We will disconnect them but not reconnect them in that case. Or it's easier actually if you're in the cloud, in the case of a cloud-based mailbox that you want to disable access to, you simply disable the protocol for the mailbox, and that takes effect immediately and kicks them out right away. So even if there's a session in process, disabling the protocol kicks them right out. Speaking of ActiveSync and Windows Phone, it's getting harder and harder to keep track of what ActiveSync functionality is available in which version of Windows Phone. So what we've actually done is we've actually started a wiki that we have created internally and we're still maintaining. And it's a list, basically, of all the various levels of ActiveSync that we have, going back to 2003 SP2, and the different versions of Windows Phone and the features that you get based on that combination. Now, this table that you're seeing is a very, very small subsection of the overall table. If you go to that page, if you go to this page right here, you'll see a very, very long table. Here you're only seeing things that really showing just the first few policies that are available. There are many, many more things that are available in the ActiveSync stack. And this will tell you, you know, what's supported in 2003, what's supported in 2007, what's supported in 2010, and so forth. How many of you use delegates or have an organization where you use delegated mailboxes? Ooh, awesome. Well, there's a phenomenon, a little problem that occurs when you have a large number of delegates. Outlook has this feature called auto-mapping. And what auto-mapping does is when I open Outlook, every mailbox of which I'm a delegate is also opened by Outlook at that time. If I just have one or two mailboxes, that's not really such a big deal. It's okay. But if I have, but if I have 20 mailboxes, 30 mailboxes, or maybe I'm an admin for many, many people and I've got lots of mailboxes that I'm a delegate for, when I open my mailbox, I do not get access to my own set of folders in the information store unless and until all the other mailboxes that I'm a delegate of are opened as well. So that means the first time you open Outlook, it could be a pretty painful experience if you have a lot of delegate mailboxes. So you've got two choices. The user can sit and suffer with that experience and just get used to waiting, or we now allow you on the server side in SP2 to actually disable the auto-mapping functionality. And what that does is it still connects the user to the mailbox, but it doesn't expand and connect the information store until the user actually goes in and chooses something in that tree. So they'll still see all the mailboxes that they have delegate access to in their tree, but we won't be opening them one after the other after the other. So their Outlook experience is, boom, open it up and I'm in my mail. If I need to go into one of the delegate mailboxes, I can double click and boom, we open it at that time and I'm right in the delegate mailbox. So this makes for a much, much better experience for users that have a large number of delegates. And it's a server-side change, so you don't have to touch the clients. Now, how many of you have more than 20,000 mailboxes in your environment? All right. How many of you have more than 50,000 mailboxes? Any more than 100,000? All right, awesome. So those of you with very large environments, you're going to need to do a little bit of extra maintenance that smaller environments typically don't have to do. That doesn't mean those of you with smaller environments will never have to do this, but it's the larger environments where this will manifest itself the most. So the issue is, when you are removing mailboxes from the mailbox database, there's two things that have to happen. First, obviously, we need to mark that mailbox as deleted inside the database itself. But then second, we need to disconnect the mailbox from the users associated with an Active Directory. Because largely, when you think about it, that's all an Exchange mailbox is an attribute of a user object in Active Directory. So we need to do those two things. Sometimes those two things don't happen. Now, the commandlets are very, very good about doing the disabling and marking it as disconnected inside the store. But the Active Directory doesn't always get updated with that information in very large environments. So what you end up having to do is you have to run this process called Clean Mailbox Database. And it will go through and look for the disconnected mailboxes and reconcile that with what's in AD. So if AD doesn't have the correct information, it'll go ahead and put that correct information in there and basically sync up what AD and what the information store think about the contents of the database in terms of which mailboxes are in it. Now, the one caveat I found with using Clean Mailbox Database is the only identity parameter it will take is the GUID of the database. You can't pass in the database name, you can't pass in the database identity. It has to be the GUID of the database. So there's two ways that you can get the GUID. One is to just use Get Mailbox Database and pipe that out so that it formats a list and then provides both the identity and the GUID of the database, so you get the name and the GUID of the database. Or if you want, you can simply run Get Mailbox Database and then pipe that to Clean Mailbox Database. The one thing I would caution you about, though, is the second command is very, very heavy. It's doing all your databases. Okay? You may not want all of your databases to be cleaned at the same time. You might want to stagger that by perhaps scoping it to databases on a server or a small set of servers. If you're in a small environment with maybe 20 databases or fewer, I'd say the bottom one is largely safe to run. If you're in a very large environment where you've got maybe hundreds of databases, you don't want to run the bottom one because it will take too long to do that kind of stuff. Do it in batches. Okay, this one is short and easy. Had a customer ask, we do a lot of mergers and acquisitions, and we need to have a complete list of every single email address we have broken down by all the SMTP domains that we have. And that actually turned out to be really easy. It's actually just this one-liner. It's word-wrapped for readability, but it's just a one-liner. Just using get recipient, looking at email addresses that match their domain. So here you would replace contoso.com with whatever domain you want. And then we just pipe out the name and the email address to a text file, and we're using the double pipe so that we can append to the text file. If you have multiple domain names, you could just keep running this for each domain name, have it appended to the same single text file, and you'll end up with one large list of every single email address in use in your organization, including, by the way, mail-enabled public folders. Okay, so this is a great inventory mechanism that turns out to be very, very easy to get this information. How many of you guys like watching videos about Exchange? Okay. I know they're not as fun as watching, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson sing about the universe, but there's still some pretty cool. But you might be surprised to know that there are more than 1,000 videos about Exchange in existence. And not just videos that Microsoft have created, others have created. How do I know this? I counted. I counted every single video I could find, and finally, once I reached 1,000, I decided to stop counting, so. But you can find them on the Exchange Tech Center. Those are the ones that we produce. You can find them on YouTube. We also have some that we produce on there. Also, there's many from other MVPs and other consultants and so forth. TechNet Edge, which is a great place for Exchange videos, for like interviews of Exchange people. Channel 9, that's actually where you'll go after the event to see the Tech Ed content. The Exchange Server in Depth, which we now call Microsoft Ramps and so forth. And lots of other third-party videos as well. So if you're thinking about creating your own video for Exchange, please don't. We're full. No, I'm kidding. No, create one, feel free to, but you might want to have a look and see what's there first, because you might imagine with 1,000 videos, we pretty much have almost everything covered. There's very, very few scenarios that you can't find a video for, so I strongly encourage you to go check those out. And since you guys like free stuff, there's also a great free script repository as well. Now, this URL will take you to the script repository where you'll find 2010 scripts, but once you're on this site, you'll also find scripts for 2007 and even some VB and C scripts for 2003 as well. Now, the thing about these scripts, though, is that only a couple of them are actually created by Microsoft. In the case of the script repository, we are acting as a distributor only, okay, which means we don't test the scripts, we don't validate the scripts, we don't support the scripts, and we're not even the ones licensing the scripts to you, unless we happen to be the ones who made the script. But most of these scripts were not made by us. There are community-driven scripts that are free for everyone to download. When you download them and you sign the license agreement, you are signing a license agreement with the author and owner of that script, not with Microsoft. So just keep that in mind. You would get support for the script from the community, from the author, not from us. But there's some awesome stuff in there. I highly recommend you check that out. In fact, one of the cool things that's in there is this Exchange 2010 architecture report. They call it an architecture report, but I like to think of it more as an on-demand type of health check, and it's one that can also be scheduled as well. And so what it is, it's this script. This is the GUI. There's a command line version that you can use to schedule it. But the GUI that I'm showing you, basically you can go through it. You can check off what sort of things that you want. You know, if you want to look at your client access servers or your DAGs or whatever, you check off what you want and you hit execute. And then it will go in and gather reporting information about the tests and the architecture elements that you've chosen. And the report looks something like this. This is actually taken from the website itself, and the author has redacted some stuff, so you won't expect black squiggly things all over your reports. But this is what one of the reports look like. So you might almost think of this as a daily health check where you can choose the items that you want and then use the command line version of the script to just execute that on a regular basis. And once the script is doing its thing, it can produce these reports, which can go, you know, to a SharePoint site, to an intranet, or to a local file system on your desktop. And then every morning when you get in, you double click, you open the report, and you got an instant health check as to what's going on with your Exchange servers. Again, pretty cool, and it's free. The source code's also available for this as well if you want to modify it. Now, how many of you have tiered levels of help desk support in your organization? Okay, almost everybody. That's pretty good. So this was actually a kind of a unique situation. There's an organization, and they have these help desk personnel, and they only want the help desk people to be able to approve quarantined ActiveSync devices that are owned by the executives. You know, for instance, if the executive goes to the store over the weekend, they buy a new device, they want to start hooking it up to Exchange, and because the administrator has invoked our allow block and quarantine features, they have to get permission before the device is authorized to actually sync up. But the challenge was the organization didn't want the help desk people to have any more rights to the Exchange system other than being able to approve the delegate operations for the ActiveSync devices. So that meant we had to get a little bit clever, because when you think about it, we're talking about permissions. Okay? And this was using the RBAC permission model. This is actually not something you would be able to do easily in the split permission model. But in the RBAC model, it turns out to be a lot easier than you might think. Now, one of the challenges in RBAC is that you cannot modify the default role groups, which means if I want to make any one of you an ActiveSync administrator, I add you to the appropriate role group, but now you have the ability to run a whole slew of commandlets and execute against many, many parameters for those commandlets. In my mind, I only want you to do this one specific thing, which is approve ActiveSync devices. So the solution here was actually pretty clever. First, it involved taking all the appropriate people who were involved, the help desk technicians, putting them into a security group, and that security group was then mail-enabled so that they could receive notifications from the system as to when a user was quarantined so that they would have something to act on. That's how they know that they need to go and allow a device. They get a message from the system that says, so-and-so's device has been quarantined, please approve this, and they go in and approve it. The next thing we had to do was take the role group itself that included this particular commandlet, set cast mailbox with the ActiveSync allowed device IDs commandlet, and we copied that role group. We made a copy of the default role group that contains it. You can't modify the default role groups, but any copies of them that you make are your own custom role groups that you can completely modify. So in that role group, we simply removed all other commandlets, and for this one particular commandlet, all other parameters except for the parameter that they needed. It's very easy to do that. We just took away everything they didn't want them to have and left them with the one thing we did want them to have. Then, at that point, everything was pretty much in place. They were getting the email messages. They had permissions to go ahead and do the allow, and everything was controlled through groups, so it didn't have to be managed on an individual help desk technician. Now, these are the general steps on how you do that. The actual commands and parameters that you would run are in the notes section of this slide. So when you download the slide deck, you'll see in the notes sections the step-by-step that you have to do all these things, creating the group, copying it, removing commandlets, et cetera, et cetera. That's all documented in the notes section of this slide. Okay, how many of you are using load balancers? Yay, it should be almost everyone, yay. Okay, but how many of you can keep it straight as to who needs affinity and who needs persistence and what goes where? Yeah, I can't either. It's too hard. There's too many protocols. It's too much stuff. So I developed this cheat sheet. And so now I'm sharing the cheat sheet with everybody. So you can take this cheat sheet and you'll know at a glance when you're working with your load balancers or when you're working with a vendor or configuring things, what needs persistence, what needs affinity, et cetera, all at a glance. Instead of having to wade through lengthy articles that describe things in detail, which you may not need to know at that moment. And again, I've broken it down into the different workloads. So the up at the top of the HTTP workloads and down at the bottom of the TCP workloads. But it's basically every client protocol that goes against an Exchange CAS server that would need some form of load balancing is on here. Pretty much the only thing that I don't have on here is the SMTP load balancing, but that really doesn't apply because that isn't a very confusing thing to keep track of. But everything else is here for you to use. And as you can tell, we love to create tables on our wiki. We love to document things extensively. So just as we've done, as you saw historically with the ActiveSync stuff, we've also done the same with OWA and Outlook Web App as well. And we give you a comparison of all the features going all the way back to 2007 and carrying forward. And again, this is a very, very short list. The table's much, much longer. You're only seeing the email stuff here. There's other stuff, calendaring, tasks, et cetera, et cetera. So this table just goes on and on and on. And it is your complete matrix as to all the feature sets that we have across all the versions of OWA and Outlook that we have, including Outlook Anywhere as well. So if you've ever wondered, you know, what features do you get with which client, now you know. Okay, the last section I want to talk about is the known issues section. These are things that I said, you know, we know about, and either we're working on them or we're working with a partner on them, depending on what the issue is. And I mention these not to call anybody out, not to air dirty laundry or anything, but just to make you aware of things that we're seeing in the forums and in various other places, things that are being reported in PSS, things that people are telling us at events like this and so forth. This is just really more for general awareness. So let's talk about a bug we introduced with update rollup 3. Okay, there was an unfortunate bug in there that is causing a string to fire. And the string, as you can see, says unhandled exception, the user setting preferred site is not available. This bug will only manifest itself in environments that include Exchange 2003 mailboxes that are accessing those mailboxes through an Exchange 2010 CAS that is running SP2 update rollup 3. Now, despite what the error message says, there is no exception happening. There's no crash that's happening. Nothing is actually happening other than code mistakenly triggering the string to get logged into the event log. That is literally all that's happening here. The event can be completely ignored. Completely ignored. I bring it up, though, because it's going to be spamming your event log if you're in that scenario. If you don't have any Exchange 2003 mailboxes in your environment, you will never see this. But if you have 2003 boxes in your environment and you're accessing through the CAS that has SP2 update rollup 3 on it, you will absolutely see this. And you may need to adjust any monitoring or event log collection tools that you're using to filter this event out. It is completely meaningless. It can be completely ignored, and it's being erroneously triggered by a bug that we introduced. Nothing bad is happening behind the scenes. The only thing that's actually happening is the event showing up in the event log when they access their mailbox. Okay, ActiveSync and bring your own device. I'm not going to talk about every issue that we know about, but I will talk about issues that we have documented in these KBs. And in fact, if you go and you read these KBs, every one of them says that this is a known problem by the device manufacturer that is being worked on by the device manufacturer. And I stress and emphasize that because there's nothing that we can do on the server side to fix these particular issues. It's not a bug in Exchange. It's not a bug in ActiveSync. It's a bug in the way that the devices have implemented ActiveSync that are causing these things to occur. I'm not going to mention any device names or manufacturers. And again, that's simply because we're not trying to call anybody out. Plus, if you are affected by this, you know who makes your devices. So I don't need to mention any names. We don't mention the names in the KB either, but we do let you know that the vendors do know about this and they're working on it. So if you're seeing things like high CPU, that's probably one of the more common ones. That's happening out there. We have no control over that. You may need to do something with these devices until your device manufacturer has a fix for you. The duplicate contacts, that's another common one as well. Calendar items missing on 2007. That is not a typo. I know it says 2007, but I also know that some of you are running 2007, and I thought I'd mention this as well. Now, I will also say, I don't have a slide on it, but I don't mind also saying that there are also known issues with Windows Phone, and in particular, calendaring items, for example. So there's a known issue in Windows Phone 7.5 that doesn't appear in Windows Phone 7, where attendees can disappear from a meeting if you manipulate that meeting item through a Mango device. So that is a regression that's been introduced in Mango. We don't have a fix for that yet, but it is another known issue. So generally, you can see across the board with devices that there are some known issues around ActiveSync and email messages. So just generally be aware of that in your environment, because this proliferation of devices is not only causing these issues, but of course it's increasing your connection count and perhaps throwing off your scalability numbers that you planned for when you did your capacity planning. Okay, this one is kind of a obscure one, but I thought I'd mention it because when I first found out about it, all of a sudden, right after the week after, there were like four customers that suddenly ran into it. And it didn't seem to be very common at first, but now we're seeing more and more people see that. So how many of you use all numeric domain names? Oh, awesome. Good for you. They're legal, but they can cause problems because some developers don't take the extra time to write the code that distinguishes between an FQDN that's all numbers and an IP address, which also looks like an FQDN that's all numbers. And so that's actually the phenomenon that's coming up here is we see something like 123.com or 456.net, and we are misinterpreting that as an invalid FQDN, when in fact it's perfectly valid. So this is a bug in our code that we know about, that we're working on. The only workaround that we have, though, right now is for you to use a witness server that has a different domain name. So that could mean involving, you know, renaming a witness server and so forth. But fortunately, it didn't look like anybody in here is having that problem, because none of the hands went up when I asked. But if you are running into the problem, that is unfortunately the only workaround that we have until we actually fix it in an update rollup. Last thing I want to talk about is a error message I spoke and wrote and blogged about a little over a year ago. And this was a code bug where any customer that was using a non-Exchange 2010 server for their witness server they would all run into this. There's no way around this. They were going to run into this bug. And it's actually two bugs, not just one. So the first bug is we're checking for the wrong permissions. Okay, so that's one bug. We are checking to see if the witness server is a member of the Exchange Trusted Subsystem group. It will only be a member of that group if it's an Exchange 2010 server. If it's not, it shouldn't be a member of that group. But we're erroneously checking for those permissions anyway. So that's bug number one. We're getting rid of that check. Bug number two is when we do check the permissions and they fail, because it will always fail on a non-2010 server, we put up a wrong error message. That's bug number two. And the error message says, you didn't configure things right. Your witness server is not configured properly. So even if you followed all the guidance, did everything perfectly right, and you're using a non-2010 witness server, you still get that message that makes you believe that you did something wrong. So this was actually kind of a strange bug to get fixed, because when a customer was facing this, they would call in CSS for help, and CSS would say, you know, they do check a couple things, check the witness, check quorum, everything checked out fine. So CSS would say, oh, you can safely ignore this error, it's a known bug, do you want to escalate it? And they almost always say no. No one ever escalates that. And as a tip, one of the better ways to get bugs fixed is to have customer escalations behind it. Not all bugs will require that, but some bugs like this, which are kind of obscure, they're not really harming anything, but it's kind of embarrassing to have it in there in the first place. Those kinds of things, they can be a little difficult to get fixed without customers escalating this. Finally, after about a year of trying to get this fixed through customer escalations, I just gave up and I decided to go directly to the release manager. And I basically hounded him to get this fixed, and now I'm happy to announce that this will be fixed in update rollup 5. I don't have a date for you, but update rollup 5, finally, after more than a year, this annoying little message is getting fixed, and this bug will go away. So just thought I'd share that with you. Okay. So with that, that's everything I have today. We do have like 3 minutes left if you have any questions, which I'd love to hear. If you don't have any questions now, but you have some later, there's all my contact info. Feel free to send me mail whenever you want. And so with that, I want to thank you all for coming. I want to invite you to attend the High Availability Deep Dive tomorrow. I also want to invite you to attend the Microsoft Exchange Conference in Orlando, Florida, in the U.S. in September. You may have heard about this conference, and you may be upset that you're at this conference and not that conference, but the reality is they are not competing with each other. TechEd is all about Exchange 2010. MEC will be all about Exchange 15. Okay, so if you're interested in the next version of Exchange, that's where you would want to be to find out about it. There's lots of different sessions that we have, not just my sessions, but there's still other link sessions. Still got some great track resources for you. And, of course, don't forget to fill out your evals as well. It's very important. Okay, so with that, let's go ahead and take any questions that you might have. You may need to shout it out as people are sort of milling about. I don't see any microphones in the room. But if you have a question, just go ahead and raise your hand. Otherwise, thank you for coming.